Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Gist is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code GIST at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, January 26th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And I have to tell you, I had amazing insight into the George Pataki endorsement of Marco Rubio. How much of the needle this would move? Would that needle be found in the political haystack that is George Pataki's future? But then there was breaking news. Abe Vigoda has died. Now, if you don't know Abe Vigoda from Fish or Barney Miller, you probably know him from being the celebrity who people keep saying has died, but this time he really has died. I want to take you back to clearly his best role. He played a Kappa regime under the Don. He played Tessio, Sal Tessio. And here, in his last scene in The Godfather, he tries to get out of what he surmises correctly to be an assassination. He appeals to Tom Hagen, and we'll hear what he says.
Tom, can you get me off the hook? For old time's sake.
Back then, you have to realize that a plea for old time's sake, it held a lot of sway. People would often give you allowances, give some leeway once you appeal to for old time's sake. You want to know why? Because remember, we're talking about pretty long time ago. The Godfather was set in post-war period. And for old time's sake, it was a lot closer to the time period then. People remembered for old time's sake. You think I'm kidding. But I think if we say now, come on, for old time's sake, or it's like an old timey, which I don't like saying old timey. But if we say old timey, we pretty much evoke a newsreel, maybe flappers. And I think it was the same period that it evoked then. It evoked the war. Yeah. Still the same. Old time, much better. People would do things for old time's sake back then. I could make another point through the prism of Fish, through the prism of Abe Vigoda, that age has become something totally different in our society. Well, first of all, he starred in this sitcom called Barney Miller. And Barney Miller was the brownest show on the history of television. I don't mean the composition of the cast, though Ron Glass was a member. I mean, just the tone, the palette. It was brown. It was the brownest of browns. It was the bourbon of shows. There's more brightness and light in 12 minutes of Friends than there were in the entire course of Barney Miller. And then Abe Vigoda got a spinoff of Barney Miller, and it was called Fish. I will play you a clip from Fish.
Yeah? I kissed you.
I know.
Don't you want to kiss me back?
Let's control ourselves. This is not our anniversary.
I remember a time when you used to show me a lot of affection.
Well, that was during the war. Everybody got scared.
That was with his wife, Bernice. And that really shows the triumph of acting over material. I got a little laugh during the war. Like I said, everyone was scared. Now, I'm going to read you an article about Abe Vigoda getting this show. Here it is. It was written by Jay Charbot, the AP television writer at the time, and it appeared in the February 4th edition of newspapers across America. Having kids around will make you feel young again, says Bernice, wife of Detective Fish. The door old cop replies, I don't want to be young again. I was young once and I wasn't good at it. Thus will veteran actor Abe Vigoda, who has become to ancients what the Fonz is to teeny boppers, check in Saturday night in his new home and his new ABC series, Fish, a spinoff of Barney Miller. All right, remember, that was written in 1977, and Abe Vigoda was old, door, talks about being young once. In 1977, that was 39 years ago. Abe Vigoda has been an old, broken-down man for 39 years. Now, 39 years ago, Abe Vigoda was 94 years old. So 39 years ago, Abe Vigoda was 55. Do you know who else is 55? What actor is 55 now in the news with a new series? David Duchovny is the same age as Fish was when Fish was on Barney Miller. You have a further mind blow. Mark Harmon, who I don't really know, but always top surveys, is a guy on TV that everyone knows. He's 64 years old. So age has changed, and Fish epitomizes this more than anyone. Fish lived in my neighborhood. I should say Abe Vigoda lived in my neighborhood. I would see him walking about. He would dine in a cafe with a glassed-in enclosure, and I dubbed that the Vigodararium. No, it didn't really take off. And also, he was a Jewish gentleman who frequently played Italians, not as Phil Fish, but there as Tessio. And I was recently talking with Paul Giamatti, an Italian man frequently cast as a Jew. I was talking Vigoda with Giamatti. It all comes full circle. Bernice, Fish will be missed. On the show today, I spiel about, but really against, Iowa. OK State, terrible date. But first, he's playing supervillain Lex Luthor in the new superhero movie Batman vs. Superman. And he was, of course, nominated for an acting Oscar, not for a superhero or a supervillain, but for the super ambivalent Mark Zuckerberg, which gives me an idea for a character. Just super ambivalent figures. Maybe the superpower is the ability to inspire ambivalence. You saved our town from a dangerous gang, but allowed gentrification afterwards. That super ambivalent man. Anyway, crazy idea, right? Here's Jesse Eisenberg, actor, yeah, sure, but for our purposes, funny writing guy, to wit. Jesse Eisenberg, the playwright and author, is out with a new collection of short stories, Bream Gives Me Hiccups and other stories. We're going to talk to him about that and about the fact that he's also named after that famous actor guy. Wait a minute, he is the actor guy. Hello, yes. Jesse, how are you?
Hi, great. Thanks, Mike.
Bream is a funny word.
Yes, it is. Thanks a lot. Yes.
And in fact, it's so funny you put it on the cover, but is it actually in the book?
No. Yeah. I wanted people to judge the book by its cover positively, so I had an entirely inaccurate cover drawn. Yeah, it's a funny word. It's a controversial word I've discovered because it's pronounced differently depending on if you're from the Union or Confederacy.
Okay, so I heard you on the Diane Rehm show where this came up.
Sure.
Or the Diane Rehm show, maybe.
Here's an email from Nick who says, the fish bream is universally spoken brim.
But I thought, well, that's like someone saying it's not pronounced creek, it's pronounced crick.
Wait, you mean like a water, body of water?
Yeah, you know, in the South, they'd say it's a crick.
Oh, I see.
I think that when something's spelled B-R-E-A-M,
yes,
and famous baseball player Sid Bream,
right,
led the way on this, that we must pronounce it Bream.
Yes, except I think I gave that guy a creak in his shoulder from his anger.
Yeah, creak in the neck. And the reason it's called Bream Gives Me Hiccups is the person saying that is a 9-year-old restaurant reviewer.
Yeah, that's right.
So when I heard or when I read the chapter title, which promised me a 9-year-old restaurant reviewer, yeah, I kind of braced myself because I thought it was going to be one of these kids who will say, I don't like the mouthfeel of this, or who will actually critique,
right,
based on a place of information. I find a 9-year-old doing that really obnoxious.
Yes, me too. And that was my initial idea with writing this. So wouldn't it be funny to have a kind of 9-year-old restaurant critic evaluating food that he should not be allowed to have purchased? And then once I started writing it, I realized, oh no, this actually should be a real character with real thoughts and a worldview that, you know, kind of supersedes my own profound worldview, which is limited.
Yeah. And the kind of kid who really won't like super fancy food and really will like Museum of Natural History dinosaur nuggets.
That's exactly right. Yeah, which is true. I went to Nobu Malibu, which is a fancy restaurant, obviously, in California on a date with my girlfriend. It was an anniversary. It was a big date for us, and there was kids sitting next to us at the next table, and the little girl was asking her mother, Mom, do I like hamachi? And the mom was saying, no, honey, you don't like hamachi. She's saying, do I like tamago? Oh, she said, yes, that is. That's an egg. You like that one. And I just thought, oh, that seems odd.
Where do they go from
here?
This kid
in that context. Yeah. Yes. And then on the other hand, I grew up going to Chi-Chi's, which was the local Mexican restaurant, and I imagine that, you know, there were some kids who never got to go to a restaurant, so I imagine it's all relative.
But didn't they serve chips and a sombrero at Chi-Chi's?
I
the ridge of the sombrero? Niro?
Yes, and then the dip was in the was in the head part.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So what, you're saying I get a pass?
No, I'm saying it was an upscale restaurant. That, to me, is upscale.
Oh, I see. I see. What did, where did they serve your chips as a child?
They served it in the Hamachi.
Oh, actually. Okay.
Yeah. Contained within the Hamachi.
I see.
So this, we should say that it's not just a gag. I thought I was very happy to read kind of seven restaurant reviews written by a little kid. But it adds up to a novella, essentially.
Yeah.
There's an arc.
That's right.
We find out about the kid's relationship with the mother. And we find out about take and observations. And so it strikes me that that's a challenge for a writer, because you want to observe things, but you also have to make the observations authentic as coming from a nine-year-old.
Yeah, that's right. But I think what I discovered was that not only could I find his worldview to present an authentic adult world, but actually in some way it was more insightful because he is seeing through the hypocrisies that adults have all agreed upon to get through the day.
Yeah, it's more pure. It's less sullied. It's an Emperor's New Clothes thing. They're literally not seeing a lot of the window dressing. They're just going right to the quintessence of, say, a lie or a hypocrisy. Kids notice hypocrisies. They don't even, because they don't see around the hypocrisy.
That's right. In fact, he even says something along the lines of, kids think more like themselves because they haven't spent so much time with other people.
Yeah. These are the dangers of being habituated.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So I also notice most of, there are a few towards the back that this is not true of, but almost all of the essays and short stories and just bits of whimsy in this collection are what we'd call third person. But more than that, it's not just that it doesn't say I. They're second person, actually. They're speaking to an intended audience.
Right.
They're dialogue.
Right.
And even when they're epistolary, like Harper Jablonski, great name, I'll get back to that. When Harper Jablonski is writing letters, you know, it's all like dialogue or some version of dialogue meant to have an impact on the audience. And I couldn't help but thinking, oh, well, all of your past writing, I think, that's been published is plays. And so I wondered if that was a coincidence.
Yeah. I found in college and in short story classes that I don't describe sunsets well, but I do write dialogue well. I really enjoy kind of writing an interior monologue rather than, you know, a description of something omnisciently. I'd rather describe a person kind of being annoyed by a sunset because it's making their face itch because they haven't been out in the sun, than describing the orange hues that are, you know, being emitted. I just don't do that well.
So when we talk about dialogue, is the dialogue that's presented here, which is good, and the dialogue that you'd write for a stage show versus the dialogue, so one versus two versus three, which is movie dialogue, there are different things we'd call great dialogue, but I think they'd all be really different. Not just length, but the thing we call great dialogue in a movie and the thing we'd say, oh, it reads like real life dialogue in a book, are totally different.
Oh, that's very interesting. And I suppose that has to do with when we referring to dialogue in a movie, it's usually being filtered through an actor's performance.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the success of that dialogue or failure has to do with the actor's presentation of it.
Absolutely.
Whereas dialogue in just a read document, I suppose, lives and dies on its construction within the page.
I'm sure you've had this happened to you 100 times more than I have, but I remember I read Paul Newman's scene, Final Address to the Jury and the Verdict. I read it on the page in a monologue book for young actors, actually. I'm like, this is great. And I performed it. And I performed it. Yeah, I'm telling you how I performed this. Yeah. But anyway, I performed
it. I'm taking notes.
As I imagined, like, impassioned lawyer would perform it. And I pounded my fist. And I think I got the role of Captain Hook in Peter Pan.
And then
I saw the actual movie. And it's totally different, and he's totally defeated. And you're like, wow, those are two totally different bits of dialogue.
Let me ask, did you prefer his take on it?
Well, you know, I didn't really understand the whole character arc, and I can't say I was better as Hud, and I was better as Cool Hand Luke,
sure.
But he was better as Frank, the attorney.
As that role.
Yeah.
It's ironic that he actually played those roles then. You know, it almost seems like what was lost in your absence.
It is odd. I do have a spreadsheet of roles that Newman was better than me and roles that I was better than Newman. And it's 50-50 right now.
Is there any kind of a Venn diagram presentation of it where there's an overlap?
Mm-hmm.
What?
We're both excellent at salad dressing. We keep it simple.
Right.
Exactly.
All the proceeds go to charity, I hope.
He's much better. His due. That's fine.
Okay, right.
I have my brand of Mike Pesca's Paul Newman salad dressing.
Right, yeah. All proceeds go to your own coffers.
Yeah, right. It gets funneled through a third agency. Did you go to college?
Yeah. Oh, I went for anthropology, though.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Your mom's an anthropologist of some sort.
Oh,
right? No.
No, close. She was a birthday party clown.
Right, right. Yeah, but then, but now she's getting a doctorate.
No, oh, yeah, yes, she is. Yeah, very good. Yes, that is true. Yeah, my mom's, she's getting a doctorate in medical humanities.
Medical humanities.
Close.
But it also would seem to me that you're simultaneously in the world of acting, but also in the world of observing. And we know that actors are supposed to be observers, but when you're remembering the lines and saying the lines and doing the business, how much observing can you be doing? So this is the book of an observer. This is the book of an anthropologist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I liked about kind of my studies in college was, you know, as an actor in acting class, you're kind of really doing a lot of performing and a lot of self-analysis. You know, what roles can I play? How can I change myself to play this role that I probably wouldn't play in the real world, but that I can play in acting class. And in with what I studied, your own performance, you know, you're only considering your own place in the world in relation to other cultures or, other places. And before I was an actor who got noticed on the street, I would spend a lot of my time eavesdropping. I can't do that as easily or as readily now, but that was my favorite thing to do.
That must suck, being noticed all the time.
It sucks if you're interested in eavesdropping.
Yeah.
It doesn't suck if you're interested in asking people about themselves, which is what I do. So when I meet people, I get to find out and ask them kind of invasive questions because they've already burdened me with asking me something, so I can turn the tables and I can ask them about themselves. So it actually provides this unusual window into getting to interact with somebody who is otherwise a stranger.
But do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
Well, I guess like anybody else, it depends on the context. But I'm really extroverted when I'm alone at home.
Yeah. But when you, I guess classic definition, if you're at a social event with people you don't know, does it sap your power or does it sap your energy or does it give you energy?
I don't know. I'm also in this very weird position where I'm very rarely in a position where I don't know the people because people feel like they know me by virtue of being in mainstream things.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like it's like a universal icebreaker in a way.
Do people feel they know you as Zuckerberg first and then everything else second? Do they feel they know you
since I was born, that's how people have referring to me, which is then strange because they actually made a movie about that guy. And
the role he was born to play.
Yes, exactly.
Also, he's a bald, multi-billionaire, super genius, evil guy. That's the other thing they always said about you.
When I was first born, I was
one
of those things. Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly.
I want to ask you about, this is what I wanted to ask you about, the social network and Zuckerberg, because I think you were great in that. And of course, the guy you were playing, I've heard in interviews you say, well, the real guy, and it's not you. Obviously, it's not you. He's a jumping off point for some ideas about the character, ideas that Aaron Sorkin fleshed out in a great way, ideas that you filled up with how you played it. And yet, isn't there a value? This is what I don't know the answer to. There is a value to the fact that we really did use his name. And there is a little bit of extra excitement when you say based on a true story.
Right.
And I just interviewed the actors from Spotlight.
Right.
And they said, you know, one of the great things about Ruffalo is he really got the real guy's mannerisms.
Right.
So on the one hand, the verisimilitude is something we prize. But on the other hand, the fact that it's so not real is something we should not only accept, but have find a value in there.
Right. I mean,
I have no question, but no, I know you've thought about that.
I thought about it a lot. And I think like accuracy is great insofar as it supports the tone or the story or the texture of the piece. I think one of the ways we engage with fiction is relating it to real life. It's this thing that Hollywood, I think, does well a lot, but it's a trick, which is that it gives you the illusion that you're learning something important. So you're not just wasting the 2 hours, that it'll somehow inform a real world thing you're going to discuss.
Yeah. And I think the discussion we have about that is a little bit of a stunted discussion, which is, hey, come on, it's Hollywood. They have to take some shortcuts. But when they don't take shortcuts or when it's so accurate, then that becomes this breath of fresh air. Well, well then what does that say about Selma and all the excuses we gave about how LBJ was portrayed in Selma?
Right.
Yeah.
I just always think, I hope they don't make anything about me. And because I can't imagine, even if the most kind of accurate depiction or the most, honorable or nobly intended depiction of a person, it still must be very uncomfortable for the people that are being depicted.
Yeah. Tell me about the thing with Marv Albert, because I remember reading it in The New Yorker.
I love Marv Albert. I've grown up with Marv Albert. And I was just thinking this guy would be the worst therapist because all of his utterances are the opposite of they're funny, but they're not sympathetic, you know, out of bounds. And just these things that seem, they're just, it's the exact opposite context of therapy, which is the kind of quiet, contemplative nodding and understanding and, you know, commiseration. And so I just thought, oh, that's a kind of funny juxtaposition, a therapy context.
All right. I was thinking that the worst, the actual worst broadcaster as a therapist would be any football broadcaster. Because at least Marv Albert doesn't use the word basketball in his catchphrases, where in football, it's always about protecting the football and moving the football down the field. And I don't know what the therapy version of that, you know, psyche, you got to protect the psyche. You got, like, once you start explicitly referencing your brain in therapy, I don't think therapy could work. I don't know, but I don't think it could work.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It's funny. So I listen to your podcast every day. I also listen to a podcast called The Starters, these NBA, the guys that talk about the NBA. And I like them too. And I was actually listening to them today. And whenever they want to make a declarative statement to kind of finalize or create a thesis around their discussion, they will use the word basketball player. He really is, though, just a great basketball player. You know, they have to kind of, it's a basketball part. It's a basketball, they can't, they're only discussing basketball players. And then they have to make the distinction of what his sport is.
Yeah, that would be good for other, hi, welcome to NPR Politics, where we talk about politician. Let's talk about politician Jeb Bush. And then he's going up against politician Marco Rubio, who really knows how to play the game of politics.
You know, Marco Rubio is just a really good Republican politician
of
politics.
He's a good Republican. If you want a Republican politician, you look no better, look no further than Marco Rubio. All right. Jesse Eisenberg is an Academy Award nominated actor. I mean, okay. You're lucky to be nominated, but I just read it because it's the first thing in your bio.
Right. Okay.
Like, it references the thing you didn't win. Everything else that I'm going to reference is an accomplishment.
Great successes.
Yeah. And then the thing you didn't win.
I was going to put is a second place Academy Award winning actor.
Right.
Yes.
He was in the final four. What if we took that construct and put it with acting?
Right.
He was in the final four of acting one year.
Actors,
five,
is acting is a kind of notoriously self-aggrandizing profession. We never, all things are wins.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, except when they see the faces. He is the author of three plays, and his new collection is Bream Gives Me Hiccups and Other Stories. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
So we asked some GIST listeners about websites that they might be working on, and one was provided by Stephen R. Fox, and the website, well, maybe I shouldn't give it out here, but anyway, it's very much like a website that would be owned by someone named StephenRFox.com. There's a nice little tab that says hello there. I clicked on the tab. There's a resume, and there are some samples of what he could do. Very simple, but it's really clean. If I was looking to hire a guy like Stephen R. Fox, not even a guy like Stephen R. Fox, who does the stuff that Stephen R. Fox does, like is a communications specialist. Yeah, this is a great advertisement for Stephen R. Fox, and in a roundabout way, a very good advertisement for Squarespace. Because Squarespace looks professional. It really does. It doesn't matter what the skill level of the person using it is. There's no coding required. Easy to use tools, very intuitive. And if you sign up now, you get a free domain for a year. So start your free trial today at StephenRFox.com. No, wait, at Squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code GIST to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful, like Stephen R. Fox did. And now the spiel, a fortnight until Iowa. It's six more days until Iowa. Have you heard that? Have you seen that on the crawl in the bottom of cable news? We've been hearing it on TV. On Sunday it was.
Right now with 8 days to go.
Then yesterday it was.
So we only have 7 days left until the Iowa caucuses.
And now right on the bottom of NBC, 6 days until Iowa. Because Iowa's a date. It's not just a place. Listen. I'll get back to you next Iowa. Wait, my calendar's full. I can't do it in Iowa. How about two New Hampshires and a Guam? Or is that too long? So 6 days until Iowa, even though Iowa's been here 170 years. But of course, we're talking about the caucuses, that exercise and democracy being exercised. They're less than a week away. Or as NBC's Pete Alexander explains it,
the candidates kicking off the final sprint to the starting line.
The final sprint to the starting line, as Usain Bolt will tell you, that is a very poor strategy to win the race. Of course, there are other things poor Pete Alexander is made to say in his job of covering the Republicans for NBC that are much crazier than sprinting to the starting line.
The NBC News SurveyMonkey Weekly online tracking poll.
The SurveyMonkey Weekly. There is an actual, I've been to NBC, I've done some TV show there. There is an actual SurveyMonkey. He wanders the hall. He's a well-trained capuchin. He both discerns public opinion and flings feces within a fairly tight margin of error. The thing about surveying your monkey weekly, they are a fickle beast. I would survey my monkey daily, though your monkey may differ. SurveyMonkey, it's like a Peyton Manning audible at the line. Survey! SurveyMonkey! SurveyMonkey Weekly! Omaha! Omaha! Brilliantly, he checked out of a run play and optioned into an isolation play using his prehensile tail and simian strength with that SurveyMonkey. Okay, I have officially now gone down a SurveyMonkey weekly hole and forgotten the important thing. The important thing is Iowa, the first true exercise in democracy. If by democracy you mean only 20% of the electorate participating, and it doesn't allow for the participation of the housebound, the hospitalized, were the merely employed at night. Now realize this, whenever you hear a candidate in Iowa talking about the hardworking men and women of Iowa who are working the night shift, who may have taken two jobs, or the working mom waiting tables so her kids can have a place to sleep, all of those people cannot participate in the vote. They can't go to an Iowa caucus because it's at night and we don't care. And there are no absentee ballots. Furthermore, the Iowa caucuses violate the principle of one person, one vote. Well, so does the Senate, which is where four of the five frontrunners have been or are employed. Okay, but in Iowa, so Bernie Sanders, he has a lot of support among college kids. Here's Kathy Obradovich, political columnist of the Des Moines Register.
What we saw in 2008 has a lot of similarities to what we're seeing this time. Bernie Sanders is doing very well with first-time caucus goers, with people who are identified as independent voters, and also with young people, caucus goers under 45. This is exactly the same coalition that Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton with in 2008.
So the Sanders coalition looks like the Obama coalition, which beat Clinton 8 years ago. Nationally, it does not look like that, by the way. This year, the Clinton coalition has a lot of African Americans, much more than the Sanders coalition. So she lost because of the black vote in 2008. She probably win because of the black vote in 2016. Anyway, my point here is about the rules. The young people who back Bernie Sanders are different from the young people who back Barack Obama. Not because they're different, not because college is different, but because of when the caucuses were scheduled. So back in 2008, the colleges were on break. So all these college kids went to their home districts and caucused for Obama there. Ah, but this year, school's in session. And if you look at where Sanders is strong, Blackhawk County, Johnson County, and Story County, those are homes to Northern Iowa, University of Iowa, and Iowa State, respectively. So in those counties, Bernie is crushing Hillary. So fine, you're saying. So he'll clean up in certain counties and not others. So what's it matter? I mean, that's how elections work, right? Democrats play well in cities, Republicans do well in the country. No. Because in Iowa, votes don't rely on voters. It's not actually about people voting. It's about counting the delegate equivalents, and candidates wind up maxing out in a county and they can't gain any more. So even if Bernie Sanders actually has the same number of people as Hillary Clinton, it could turn out that since all his people are concentrated in these few counties, Hillary Clinton will wind up winning Iowa. And by the way, there is no winning Iowa. It's all proportional anyway. This is why the Iowa caucuses are dumb, flawed. They're demographically dumb. They're democratically dumb. They're demonstrably dumb. Santorum, Huckabee. Yes, there's more complex math demonstrating the negative correlation for Republicans and winning the Iowa caucuses. But if I just say Santorum and Huckabee, that pretty much demonstrates the dumbness thereof. No? Yes. All right. Maybe here's the question. Why is Bernie Sanders successful with the kids? I have a theory. This is mad rhymes. There was a CNN town hall thing in Iowa last night, and I think Bernie Sanders was laying down a diss track. Here, check it out.
The war in Iraq. Okay, that's the fact.
The war in Iraq, that's a fact. That might be coincidence, but like 20 seconds later, same answer. He says this.
Hillary Clinton voted for the war.
She was for the war. Doesn't help the poor. Tell the millionaires and billionaires I'm laying down the law. See, here's what I think is going on. You know how all the candidates put out on YouTube all this B-roll of just them walking in a field and with their family because they can't coordinate with PACs? But the PACs know this footage is out there and they'll cut an ad with the stuff that's publicly available. I think Bernie Sanders is just throwing rhymes into the universe and he knows that people are going to be crafting this into rap, right? Somewhere Killer Mike is taking notes saying, I could work with For the War. But I got half a rhyme about the haves and the have-nots.
In which billionaires compete as to the size of their super yachts.
And there you have it. Bernie Sanders drops the mic. And that's it for today's show. Andrea Salenzi, GIST producer, got mad. He hit Bruno Tattaglia at 4 o'clock this morning. Tell Steve Lickteig it was only business. His business as executive producer of Slate Podcasts. I always liked him. They want to arrange a meeting between me and Barzini on Andy Bauer's ground, where I'll be safe. Andy Bauer's chief content officer of the Panoply Network. I always thought it would be Pesca. Nah, it's the smart move. Andy Bauer's was always smarter. Want to thank Miles Dornboss for recording this session. Miles, did I pronounce your name?
You did.
I did. I pronounced his name right. How'd you hold it together, Miles? How didn't you crack?
This close.
He was this close. The GIST, Bernice. Umperu, Deperu, Duperu, and thanks for listening.